Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the latest episode of The Interviews, the Empire Podcast spin-off show, which gathers the cream of the crop of our chats with filmdom's finest. That is a mouthful, I need to work on that. It's a shorter show this week, but no less ace as we speak to not one but two directors. First up, this week sees the release of The Devil Wears Prada 2, the long-awaited sequel to 2006's, yes you guessed it, The Devil Wears Prada. The movie that saw Anne Hathaway go toe-to-toe at a fashion magazine with its tyrannical editor, Meryl Streep. Already a hit at the time, over the last 20 years or so, the film's audience and cultural impact has grown and grown and grown. There's a West End musical with songs by Elton John to prove that. If you don't believe me, it's a lot of fun. Go check it out. And now the gang is all here for another go. That includes David Frankel, who directed the original, and we sent Helen O'Hara along to have a chat with Frankel when he came into London recently. This is obviously not a spoiler special interview, but they do discuss by name some of the A-list cameos in this film. So if you don't want that to be spoiled, maybe wait until you've seen the film. And if you don't care, then have a listen now.
Well, hello, David. How are you doing?
Helen, great to see you.
I love the red shoes. This is very on brand.
It was a gift, but they're Prada Tremors.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That was, my brother and sister-in-law and the pre-premiere gift the other day.
Amazing. So 20 years later, is this a legacy sequel or do you just see this as a sequel? Is there a difference?
I don't know. I don't know how you define legacy sequel. I mean, we never imagined that we would do a sequel. And Aline Brosh McKenna and I, the screenwriter, really spurned every entreaty to explore it. We didn't want to sully the memory of the first movie. We just lightning in a bottle. People love it. Okay, fine. Let's not ruin that. And it was only in the last couple of years that we realized maybe there is another story to tell, because the world of fashion and the world of journalism has changed so much and there are new issues. And it was important. You make a movie that's entertaining and funny and glamorous, but it's also got to be about something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, we realized, there are really interesting themes that are really relevant to the culture today that this pop movie can explore.
Yeah. That's one of the things that really struck me about, rewatching the first one and then going straight in and watching this one is, I think, like you say, people think of it as a little bit fluffy because it's about fashion and it's a young girl and we're sort of conditioned to think a certain way about those kind of movies. But, the first one dealt with the business of fashion and the seriousness of that business in quite a real way. This one really gets into some, it touches on, I'm not saying it dwells on, but it touches on some kind of things about affordability and like luxury pricing and obviously the state of the media right now. Was it always important to have that kind of balance? And
Andy has a speech in the middle of the movie and she says, she's just frustrated, another publication deleted, and we just can't keep tearing these things down and repackaging them. And where does it end? And, it's a question that we all ask, it's like this move from print to digital. Okay. We accept that, but what are the sacrifices? What are the costs? What are we losing? And, it's kind of what the internet has done to every part of the culture is, it's convenient. We can find our way without a map and, we can text at will, but, have we lost so much human connection? And now we're about to potentially lose human creativity because, the digital, the technology is about to overtake that also. And so it's really a cry in the dark, caveat, let's be careful that we're not moving too fast and all is lost.
Yeah, but fun.
But fun. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a testament to great screenwriting that, that all those themes are in the movie and yet it's full of jokes and glamour and great music and it's very entertaining and honestly, we hope leaves you wanting more.
Absolutely. I'm already obsessed with at least like four different outfits in the movie that I need to find the cheap versions of that I can afford. Amazing. But like, tell me then about getting everyone back on board for that, because it sounds like, you know, I mean, everyone is back for a start, which is quite rare in these kind of cases, I feel like. You know, did they come in with like requests for their characters and things they wanted to sort
of look at? I mean, first of all, we would not have done it if it wasn't getting the whole family. You know, it's a band, you know, it's the Beatles. You couldn't do it without, you know, George and Ringo. But we started with Meryl, obviously, because, you know, without Miranda, there's no movie. And once we presented the idea that there's a fun story, but also something that has relevance, she was really keen to explore it. And then it was really like one phone call to Annie and to Emily and to Stanley, and they all were very excited to join in. They did have requests, you know, they were fascinated. I mean, that, you know, at one point we talked, maybe Andy had gotten married and divorced and had kids, and Annie had a whole different vision for what her experience was, Andy's life over the last 20 years. Emily was, you know, thrilled to, you know, to be still play a, you know, mean, you know, mean girl, if you will. You know, she had one great suggestion when she read the script, which was that we'd missed an opportunity to have all four of them in a scene together. You know, and even though the story doesn't always bring them together, there was one moment early that made sense. And so that was a rewrite that we did on her suggestion.
That was very, very satisfying, I feel like, to get everyone back. Have they changed a lot? Because they were, especially Annie and Emily, were baby actresses at this point.
They were 22. They were girls. It was Emily's first big movie. And, you know, Annie had done Princess Diaries before, but it was, you know, the first, I mean, she was in every scene of that first movie and worked her ass off to, you know, every day. But I think you see that in their performances here. There's a maturity and there's a confidence. I mean, they're just, you know, now they're global movie stars, and they've made many more movies than I have over the last 20 years. But you know, what I admire so much is that they bring the same enthusiasm, as women and moms now that they brought when they were kids. And, you know, their work ethic is the same. I mean, and their charisma is even greater than it was, you know. So, you know, if anything, they're better than they ever were.
And it was nice as well seeing, not only Miranda back, but also Nigel back. And once again, kind of being the heart and soul and the kind of grounding force for all of these, you know, quite high strung characters.
And Stanley is, is the gift that just keeps on giving. You know, he was the last person cast in the first movie.
Really?
It's completely my fault, but we didn't cast him until we were 4 weeks into the shoot.
Wow.
You know, we were, you know, 3 days away from shooting Nigel, and there was no Nigel. And I went to lunch with Stanley, and I said, "Oh yeah, he's going to be amazing." It's just so effortless with him. Honestly, or at least he makes it look that way. But he's so soulful and so funny. What's nice is like that after 20 years, there's so much more resonance to the relationship. You know, as an audience, we fill in the blanks, and so, you know, when moments happen between them and you understand like how long he's been her number two and how long he's been disappointed and how many times, there's a real weight to it. I love that we were able to, you know, bring that much emotion to a comedy.
What was it that took so long the first time? Was it just pinning down exactly what Nigel was or who Nigel would
be? I met, you know, hundreds of men and the character kept changing, and Aline kept rewriting the character. And eventually we landed in sort of exactly the right place. He walked in and no preparation, and Patricia Field gave him this huge ring that he put on, and he said, "Okay, I've got the character," you know, and it was just that simple. Yeah. The scene that he shot first, is the scene where in the hotel room where he's telling Andy, I'm gonna go work with the you know, James Holden, I'm going to finally get to see Paris, you know. And that was literally like, that was the first moment that he was Nigel.
Yeah. That's a heartbreaking one to go back to as well. You're just like, oh.
Yeah.
Well, for Nigel. Anyway, tell me about sort of gathering cameos this time, because I feel like, I don't know, but it feels like the fashion industry as well as the movie industry has really embraced this story in all the years since. I imagine you had your pick of people, but maybe it was a little bit of a scheduling nightmare to get those people.
It was a bit of a nightmare to get everybody in the right place at the right time, but it was also a thrill. And I think we're sort of making up for the fact that in the first movie, it was so hard to get anybody to participate. And we were really fortunate that a handful of, you know, Giselle or Heidi Klum, and especially Valentino and his team, came at the very last minute to be a part of the movie. And it elevated it so much to have just that degree of authenticity, and to understand, you know, to see Miranda in a world that felt quite real. And, the whole movie gains strength from that. And I wanted to show that this is the world of a high powered magazine editor, that they, you know, they're boldface names wherever you go. And especially, you know, just when she's relaxing in the Hamptons, you know, she's not just going to have her neighbors over for tea. You know, she's going to have the most interesting people she knows, and a fantastic assortment. And then obviously, you know, when Irv is being celebrated, there's a lot of people, you know. My favorite, of course, is having Rory McIlroy appear and with his wife, Erica. So, you know, that was thrilling for me. I'm a golfer.
Right.
You know, I'm John Batiste in the Hamptons, and Donatella in Milan. You know, it just was really fun.
Yeah. And I loved, I mean, no spoilers, but I loved the Lady Gaga appearance as well. My God.
Yeah. I mean, that obviously was special. And, it was, Aline had written, you know, a pop star performs. And, you know, we went to the studio and go, well, there's one pop star we'd love to get. And, you know, fortunately, she turned out to be a fan of the first movie and was thrilled to collaborate with her. Yeah.
And she kind of plays a little role as herself as well. It's not just a performance.
Yeah, no. And Aline invented this nasty backstory for her and Miranda, and she was really keen to play it.
That's awesome. I hear that Anna Wintour visited the set. Is it true that she gave you notes on flowers?
Yes, completely true. Yeah, she came one day. We were shooting in the Dior offices, and we had decorated the office with flowers. And she turned to Aline when she was, you know, sitting at the monitor and said, "Oh, Dior would never have this many flowers, and they would only have white flowers." And so the designers went around swapping out flowers at the last minute. And you know, again, you know, it's part of our effort to be as authentic as possible. So any suggestion that, you know, makes it realer, we were happy to embrace.
Yeah. And she would know that world. So it.
Yeah. As it turned out, I went to another Dior office and they had plenty of flowers and they were different colors. I was like, what does Anna Wintour know? I'm glad we got it right.
Oh, that's awesome. And tell me about the Italian shoe. I guess having been to Paris last time, Milan was the natural port of call.
Yeah, we just, you know, we wanted to hit another great fashion center. And there's obviously, you know, amazing history of fashion and industry in Milan. And it was a city I didn't know much about. You know, I'd been there maybe 24 hours in my life. And it was fantastic to get introduced and see, you know, the history and the beauty. And so much of Milan is hidden behind, is in courtyards, you know, behind facades. And there's absolutely gorgeous art. And of course, you know, you have all these amazing Italian designers. And so we went to Fashion Week last year and went to shows and took the ride up, you know, it's only an hour up to Lake Como, and you see these amazing palazzos everywhere. So we wanted to share that, you know, the beauty and the glamour of that world with the audience and understand this is really the world that these characters, you know, would be moving in.
Yeah. And Miranda's hotel room is going to haunt my life. I feel like that was next.
You know, the crazy thing, you know, people are, it's a beautiful hotel, the Palazzo Parigi in Milan. Those rooms in the movie do not exist in real life. I just, big asterisk, you know, those were created by our production designer, Jess Gonchor, in a mansion in Long Island, New York.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So
not quite the same vibe as Milan then.
No.
So one of the things I really liked about this as well is, you've also dealt with the way that the work culture and language has changed over the last 20 years. You know, the sort of outright bullying that Miranda used to do, I think, would now be a little bit more difficult to get away with. And I love there were little kind of comic scenes sort of dealing with that. Was that something that was always in the script as well?
Yeah, that was, you know, this idea of, Miranda can't still throw her coat at people, you know, that's not going to pass muster. So she's got to learn to hang up her own coat. And, you know, she's went out of her way to hire an assistant, Amari, who, you know, played beautifully by Simone Ashley, who is her guardian, you know, just keeps her from stepping over the line too many times. And, you know, she's still capable of making a wrong move, but at least now she knows, you know, when she's trespassing.
Yeah, I thought that those scenes were absolutely great. Tell me about, you've worked with Meryl now several times.
Yeah.
What is it about her that makes her as iconic as she is in this role?
I mean, you tell me. I mean, it's just, she's memorable every time out. You know, I honestly think it's her sense of humor. You know, I think, I mean, obviously she's also, I mean, the Sophie's Choice, I mean, the incredible dramatic roles, but there's just a natural charisma and wit about her. And she's also so smart and she understands film acting, which is just, you know, I mean, obviously now Annie and Emily Stanley have learned how to do that. But what Meryl understands is that movies are edited and that you don't need to be perfect in every take. And so she's always experimenting. She's never doing the same thing twice. And that way she's free. You know, she's not locked into a performance and it feels so alive every time. It's as if she's saying the words for the first time. And it's just a really special quality.
Yeah. Well, it makes for very special films. Did you expect the first one to have the kind of tale that it's had? I mean, there's still debates online about who is the villain really and why is it Andy's friends? You know, there's a musical version. We're back here 20 years later.
Yeah. I mean, no, had no expectations of that. I've never anticipated we'd be doing a sequel. The musical is amazing. It's a testament to partly the curiosity that we all have about peeking behind the curtain at this world and, you know, the glamour of it and the risks of it. And also, the charisma of these movie stars. It all starts with great writing. You know, Lauren Weisberger wrote a really interesting novel and Aline Brosh McKenna wrote a great screenplay and it's still, you know, we quote half the script seems to be like on a tote bag somewhere. You know, it's just, it's amazing to me. I'll never not be surprised.
Have you got any plans for Devil Wears Prada 3? Maybe less than 20 years?
Plans? No. Yeah. if there is, it will definitely be less than 20 years.
I kind of want to see like Miranda versus Gaga, if I'm honest.
Yeah,
like that.
I know. Well, if it's in 20 years, they're going to be like wheelchair racing. Let's hope that we get to explore, like, you know, where they go from here.
Yeah. And has the film changed your own relationship with kind of fashion? Like, do you think about this stuff when you're getting dressed?
Can't you tell? No.
I mean, you are very well dressed today, for those listening.
Thanks to, you know, Dolce & Gabbana. In my everyday life, I'm wearing a t-shirt and jeans and I have amazing, I'm awestruck by the designers, the work they do. I mean, you know, you think about Jonathan Anderson putting out, you know, 8 collections a year for Dior it boggles the mind that the creativity. I got to meet at dinner a few weeks ago with Domenico Dolce and he's still, you know, in his 60s, he's still getting up at 5 in the morning and, you know, collecting tear sheets out of magazines and photos and inspirations and designing new collections and looking forward to the Alta Moda in July. And he's not just designing clothes, he's designing, you know, coffee cups and toasters. I'm in awe of that level of creativity. And, it's also like a slippery slope. And you know, the minute you see something and you have one thing nice, you need to go buy another nice thing. And I'm terrified of that.
Quite right. Me too, obviously. Anyway, thank you so much and best of luck with the film.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.
All right. That was David Frankel talking to Helen, and The Devil Wears Prada 2 is out in cinemas across the country, nay, the world, from tomorrow. A film that's not in cinemas, but perhaps should have been, is Ben David Grabinski's excellent time travel action comedy, Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice, starring James Marsden, Aza Gonzalez, Vince Vaughn, and Vince Vaughn as components of a love triangle so complicated that it actually has 4 points, which I guess makes it a love square. But there's nothing square. Oh my God, segue of the year is in the bag, folks, about Grabinski's movie, which is on Disney Plus and Hulu right now and is a delight full of quirky comedy, great action sequences, interesting character work, and tons of twists. Oh, and there's a scene involving Oasis's Don't Look Back in Anger, which I did not have on my bingo card before watching the movie. I was so taken by the film, in fact, that I wanted to sit down with Grabinski and pick his brains about it, which I did for a Spoiler Special interview that is up right now, folks, over on the Spoiler Special feed. You're going to get a taste of that interview right now. Now, this is an interview that's focused more on the emotional beats of the movie rather than twisty, turny, timey-wimey plot stuff. But either way, you should only listen to this if you have seen Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice. If you haven't seen Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice, then perhaps best give it a swerve until you have seen Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice. For the rest of you, here it is. Chris and Ben David and Ben David and Chris. Enjoy.
Ben David Grabinski, welcome to the Empire Podcast Spoiler Special for Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice. That's a fun title to say. Is that kind of part of how you came up with those character names?
Well, yeah, I first wanted to do kind of a very slight homage to Mikey and Nicky, the Elaine May movie. Yep. And then when it was forming itself as kind of a some very complicated marital situations, the Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice thing all kind of came together, where like I had coincidentally named her Alice, and I think I had some epiphany when I was like, oh, well, the characters are Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice, so I can kind of do the Mikey and Nicky title and kind of do the Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice title. And, you know, as much as I enjoy someone watching this movie really cold, I did come across someone who watched it very cold and somehow had dialed in so much on the title that they were expecting it kind of to be a one-to-one tonally movie to Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. And I am sorry that my movie is much dumber than that. I was not working in the same sophisticated realms as that film was.
Over here in the UK, I'm sure you know this. You're a film nerd like me. We have something called Rita, Sue, and Bob 2. Have you ever heard of that film?
No.
No? It's a sort of kitchen sink love triangle thing from the early 1980s. Really good film. Yeah. Check it out if you have.
This is going into my watch list right now.
It is nothing like your film, Ben David. Nothing like it whatsoever. But yeah, stick it on your watch list. Rita, Sue, and Bob 2.
Well, as you'll probably realize, I love all kinds of movies. So I don't require any movie I watch to be just like my movie. And to be fair, not a lot of things are, in my opinion.
This is very, very true indeed. So talk me through the process of writing this, because when you have a time machine and time travel at the heart of a film, I imagine that gives you a lot of freedom, but also it straitjackets you in a way as well. What were the biggest challenges in terms of story and plot that you had to overcome while writing?
Well, you know, the challenge was really just about keeping it more spare, because I wanted to, my priority was to make a One Night Gone Wrong movie more so than making a time machine movie. Like, I wanted to make a time machine movie where the machine blew up and anyone who can really get into the details of it is dead. Because the time machine is just an excuse to create the emotional specificity of, okay, I get one last chance to be around my dickhead self and knowing everything I know about him and that night, try to do a speed run on redemption, you know. because like something that we don't usually get to do. I mean, the way I always say it is like Back to the Future only has time travel because of the question, the emotional question, which is, what would it be like to hang out with my parents when they were my age in high school? What were they like?
Yeah.
And the time machine in this is just for the question, what if I realized too late that I sucked and ruined everyone's life around me? And I got one chance and one night to hopefully fix that. And that's it. So it's like you're trying to do a one night wrong buddy action comedy about regret and grief and redemption. And then the time machine gives them the opportunity and then it blows up. Yeah. So you're hopefully by blowing it up, you're letting the audience know that this is not a movie where they're going to just keep redoing things. That like, if someone's getting in a fight, that fight matters. It's not like they're just going to do the fight a second time. You know, there's two different versions of this movie, and the one that you might maybe expect something that's more in like a Rick and Morty manic kind of energy is the just constant doing things. You know, it's just like we're going to use it again. We're going to use it again. We're going to use it again. It's like, oh, there's three guys. No, now there's four guys. Now there's five guys. Like I wanted to take and sort of put my opportunities and choices into a more digestible bag, instead of making it feel like it is, because it is an insane movie, but you have to create some sort of guardrails for yourself, or else it's just, it could be a 3-hour movie and just by the end of it there's 80 versions of each character, and you know, it's just madness, and I didn't want to get that mad.
It's really interesting as well, because you have Vince and Vince, wildly different characterizations. Future Nick is only 6 months older than present Nick, give or take a couple of weeks, I guess. And yet he's undergone a lot of change, a lot of growth in that time. How did that dictate how Vince attacked both of those characters and approached both those characters, and how you directed him as both of those characters?
Well, I think that it's like a very clear like demarcation point. Like, you know, like if you take Scrooge at the end of the story and Scrooge at the top of the story, those are drastically different people. But for them, that's really like a span of 8 hours. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like this very high stylized journey, because someone's seeing their past, their future, learning the error of their ways. But on the same hand, when Mike died, Nick thought he knew himself, and when Mike died, he felt awful and realized that it didn't make him feel any better, and it made him realize he was a fucking shit. Mm-hmm. And then he finds out that Alice is pregnant, and Mike isn't going to be around to raise this kid, and his friend, and he no longer has his friend around, even if they'd gotten so fucked up and so estranged. He's just been living in regret for 6 months, and that's a lot of time to be living in regret and every day waking up realizing, what the fuck did I do? Like, he did this thing very impulsively. It's like he found out about the affair, and within 12 hours got all these things in motion that were going to lead to Mike's death. Mm. And he thought it would be satisfying, and it wasn't. And, you know, in life, there's a lot of times where people can make really bad mistakes, and just by virtue of reality itself, you just either have to live with them or learn from them, but you can't undo them. So it's like, if this is going to be a guy who's going to be in AA for the rest of his life or some equivalent of it, and just like, you know, he's just a fucking mess. And the movie is just like, well, what if you did get a chance to redo it? And the clarity that he has is just very lucid. You know, he's like, why the fuck did I kill this guy? I didn't even love Alice anymore. I'd been a really horrible husband. Maybe what he did is fucked up, but did I have to get him eaten by a cannibal? So when he's like living in that emotion, the way I always describe it is like, this is like the sequel to like the most dark, nihilistic, you know, crime ending. Like, the ending of, like, this story without a time machine, it's not, like, it's as bad as, like, The Long Good Friday, where it's just, like, how doomed they are. But there's that thing at the end of Mikey and Nikki where you're just seeing this close-up of Peter Falk. I'm always wondering, like, what is he thinking? Does he think that, oh, fuck, why did I just let... Spoiler alert. He's like, why did I let my friend die? Yeah. Like, you know, my friend now is kind of a jerk, but... You know, he's sitting there in that house, you know, slamming the door when the assassin comes to kill him. And what is he going to think in 6 months? You know, what is he going to think in 6 minutes? Is he going to be haunted by letting this happen, or is he going to move on?
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if he was haunted and if he wishes that he had tried to fix things, what would he do? It's not literally that.
Yeah.
But it's just sort of kind of a, it's just sort of a psychological exercise, just thinking about these characters at the end of these nihilistic endings, whether it's, you know, Mikey, Nikki, or Chinatown, or whatever.
Yeah.
Just what happens 6 months later if the world of the movie is a little dopey in a sense where you can be like, oh, yeah, and we loan money to a guy and he built a time machine with it, so we're going to use that. it's a combination of what I think is hopefully relatable. Emotional shit and also kind of goofball stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a guy who built a time machine and he never should have borrowed money from the mob in the first place to do it. I wouldn't recommend any scientist borrowing money from the mob to make a time machine. I just think it's going to end poorly. And Alice tells him, you know, in some ways he's the dumbest character in the movie. I think the movie's filled with a lot of lovable idiots, but Simon borrowing money from the mob to build a time machine and thinking that it would all work out is not the smartest thing someone's done in a science fiction movie.
That is very, very true. I am fascinated now to see Mike and Nick and Alice, which I imagine would be the prequel to this movie, which just ends with Mike being eaten by Dolph Lundgren whilst Nick has this existential awakening as well.
No, you're right. Yeah, it's like, you know, everyone in, you know, Nick wakes up and realizes Mike's gone and he was eaten by a cannibal. And then when he goes to the funeral, Alice tells him she's pregnant and he's like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
And the thing that's really interesting about the specificity of this story to me is you would know, like, this is a dumb hypothetical, but if I was mad at my friend and framed him and he got eaten by a cannibal and I heard that news and instantly felt like I was going to vomit and like I made a huge mistake, I would then know that if I recreate a similar event for my younger self so he can see what Mike's death would make him feel like, that he would realize he didn't want it to happen.
Yes.
It's because the only way they can do a speed run on redemption with the present day Nick is by putting him through the emotional roller coaster of what he thinks would be satisfaction or catharsis, but instead immediately makes him feel empty inside. So, you know, instead of trying to plead with him and convince him of how bad he's going to feel if Mike dies, they create a scenario where he witnesses it. And then lives in it and feels it. And it's a pretty mean prank. But, you know, it had altruistic reasons.
Well, listen, it works. And I love also the future Nick is really scrambling once he's in the present. But he has the wherewithal to go, oh, that special effects guy I know from 5 months down the line, I'll go to him. You know, so he begins to put a plan in place, but a lot of the time he's just improvising wildly on this night.
Yeah, that's the only thing that he, when he came back, was he thought, all right, I know where he is at this point. We're going to find him. We're going to put him in a trunk. While he's in this trunk, I'm going to pitch this plan to these people of what we're going to do. And then once we get him on board with us and he's no longer a threat, then the thing about it that, like, we don't, like, get too into details. The funny thing is he thought that if they killed the Baron and his assistants, he could just get him like the two of them, like a one way flight to, you know, some warm island on the other side of the world. And then Sosa would just be like, oh, okay, I guess they're gone. And, but what he didn't realize was, because this isn't how it played out the previous time, is that Sosa was just going to be like, no, we're going to shut down operations in the organization and nothing. There's none of our businesses are going to be functioning. Everything's on hold. No one's getting a paycheck until someone finds them wherever they are in the world and kills them and makes them realize like, oh fuck, like not the smartest guy, you know, thinking like, oh, I just kind of thought that would be enough, which then leads to, you know, them realizing sort of it's us or them, which is a little absurdist. And the thing I like about it, you know, it depends on what anyone else thinks, is a pro or a con. You do spend the first two thirds of the movie hanging out with guys who I find pretty charming. I mean, they're stupid, but I think they're very lovable. And yeah, these two things dovetail where you're like, usually these movies, when they kind of get in the finale and it's like cannon fodder, there is zero personality to any of these goons, you know, like when you're in these big finales and they're like, oh, there's like a bunch of cannon fodder guys who are going to get shot down.
Yeah.
But instead, I'm just like, these guys are pretty fun. And then now finale is, it's going to be us versus them. So it's like, you could have the finale version where there's like this big catharsis where you're like, yeah, fuck these guys. But it's a little like, ah, fuck.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
I mean, they're all in, they all do live in a dangerous world, and a dangerous lifestyle that, you know, every day you could wake up and have these things happen because they're not altruistic people, in a professional sense. But, I don't know. I find those goofballs pretty endearing. Like dumbass Tony and Jimmy Boy just has the worst night ever. He just got out of prison and he's just like trying to have a good time. Now he's having these like, you know, physical and mental issues, and finds out Mike was the rat. Seemingly the parties aren't as much fun as he thought it would be. And then also just very funny to me that there's like no women at the final party. It's just, they've whittled down into the course of that. All that's left is just a bunch of guys on coke who should have gone to bed hours ago.
Yeah.
And if they had gone to bed hours ago, they wouldn't have been there when Mike and Nick show up. So I think the moral of the story is no good can come from going to an after party.
There you go, folks. That was Ben David Grabinski talking about Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice. And if you want to hear what happens next, spoiler alert, I laugh. And then I ask another question, then he answers that question, then I ask more questions, and so on and so forth. The full Spoiler Special interview is available now over on our Spoiler Special feed. And if you don't already subscribe to that, you can do so by going to empirespoilerspecials.com, and there you can sign up. And of course, Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice, I love saying that title, is available on Disney Plus right now, or Hulu, if you are in the United States. And on that note, that is it for this episode of The Interviews. We will be back next week with a couple of absolute belters, including one James Francis Cameron, which is all kinds of exciting. The regular Empire podcast, in which I talk ship with James Dyer and Helen O'Hara, will be up tomorrow, Friday, May 1st, and also features a great interview with Callum Turner and George McKay, stars of Rose of Nevada. Check it out if you don't already plan to. The podcast it is, not the film, although you can also check out the film. I recommend doing both, in fact. Okay, that's enough for me. I'm off to get a time machine now and go back to 2006 and buy shares in The Devil Wears Prada. Can you buy shares in a movie? Don't worry, I'll get another time machine, go back further in time and make sure that you can. Sorted. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye bye.